This edition of The Globalist was first broadcast on the 27th of October 2021 on Monocle 24. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Hello, this is The Globalist. I'm Georgina Godwin, coming to you live from Midori House in London. On the show ahead...
And I would say the Chair of Ways and Means that oversees the budget is also very upset at the briefing that's gone out. At one time, ministers did the right thing if they briefed before a budget. They walked.
The latest UK budget will be laid out in Parliament today, but it will hardly be breaking news, as many of the policies have already been leaked. We'll examine the key points and ask if this is any way to manage the government's media message. In Sudan, the top general has defended the army's seizure of power, saying he ousted the government to avoid civil war. Turkey has reached out to Armenia to restore diplomatic ties, whilst Erdogan backs down in the row with 10 Western ambassadors. Then to Budapest, where the far-right leader Viktor Orban has been meeting with France's Marine Le Pen. We'll ask what that means for the European Union. We'll rustle through the papers, have a whistle-stop city tour of urbanism news, before we ask what cost a penny but is worth millions. Don't send me your clever answers, because philately will get you nowhere. First, a look at what else is happening in the news. In the US, Food and Drug Administration experts have approved the usage of the Pfizer-BioNTech COVID-19 vaccine for children aged 5 to 11, a move which should mean emergency authorization of the jab for around 28 million people within weeks. A timely new report released by the United Nations has revealed that despite global climate pledges, the world is still on course for a disastrous temperature increase. Published ahead of COP26 this weekend, the report shows we're on course for a 7.5% carbon emission reduction by 2030. That's far short of the 45% needed to limit a rise of 1.5 degrees. And Australia has confirmed that it will lift a travel ban on its citizens, which has effectively banned residents from travelling overseas for the last 18 months. Travel will now be possible for all residents from next week, provided they're fully vaccinated. Do stay tuned to Monocle 24 throughout the day for more on those stories. But first, Rishi Sunak, the British Chancellor of the Exchequer, will present the latest budget in Parliament today. Based around the Conservative Party policy of levelling up, significant parts of the budget were leaked in advance. Well, joining me are Vincent McAvaney, political reporter and regular Monocle 24 voice, and Vicky Price, economist and former joint head of the UK government's economic service. Welcome to you both. Vicky, if we could start with you and just ask you to briefly outline the key points already in the public domain.
Well, the most important one, actually, is the increase in taxation that we're likely to be seeing from next year. The National Insurance increase, which was announced just a couple of months ago and which really shocked businesses in particular, which had hoped that certainly the employer's national insurance contribution might be going down. Instead, it's going up. So that's one. The other one is the income tax increase. Now, people don't talk very much about income taxes because that was meant to be part of the manifesto of the Conservative Party in 2019. We said no increases in income tax, but of course, they also said that for national insurance contributions. But income tax is going up through the back door because income tax thresholds for when you start paying your higher tax rate are being frozen as of this coming financial year, and frozen for some time, which really means that loads more people get into the higher tax brackets. And of course, with increases in wages that we're seeing right now because of staff shortages, and also, of course, we've been hearing that public sector pay freeze may be eased as well. That will mean that loads more enter into the higher tax bracket. The estimation originally without the what's been going on recently is that 1.5 million people at least will be paying a lot more tax. But many, many more, I think, would be paying a lot more tax. So that's happening. And of course, we also have the corporation tax rise, which is an increase from 19% to 25%, which is coming into force in 2023. So the main tax issues are already there. Now, the question is, you know, if you add all those promises that have been made in terms of extra infrastructure spending here and there, for example, particularly in transport in across the country because of the levelling up programme that the government has. You know, we've already had a number of those spending points coming out too. Some of those are not very significant and some of those just repeat what's been announced before. So there's a lot out in the public domain, in fact. So what the question is, how much more is there that we don't know about?
Yeah, absolutely. Vincent, what do you think that what we know already tells us about the Conservative Party's policy making?
Well, there's a phrase that keeps being used about this budget, which is an economy fit for a new age of optimism. And I think this is the first time we're going to see Rishi Sunak, instead of being a responder and rescuer to disasters in the pandemic, it is about him trying to set out his economic vision, trying to move the country on from the pandemic, from Brexit. But as we've heard there, this isn't the, you know, high wages, low taxes, conservatism that we know around the world that they promised in their last manifesto. This is, in fact, higher taxes going up and also lower wages. Whilst the government is sort of promising, we think, to increase national insurance and lifting the public sector pay freeze, which was so unpopular last year. When you look at the fact that inflation could be as much as 5% in April, the fact that personal taxes are going up, the fact that they've cut the uplift in the universal credit, actually wages might not be going up as a result of these changes that they're doing.
Mm. I mean, Vicky, there does seem to be a great deal of obscurity, if you want to put it politely. I mean, there's double counting going on here. They're promising one thing, but in actuality, different things are happening.
Well, indeed, I think I touched on the sort of transport and other infrastructure spending that the government is announcing. But of course, there's a 7 billion or nearly 7 billion that was announced just a few days ago to be going in the various regions to improve the transport infrastructure. Some 5.5 billion of that had already been mentioned and counted for, if you like. So there's only an extra 1.5 billion that it's going to be given. Now, that is over 5 years. So it's not as if it's happening immediately. And indeed, it's quite true about the sort of a little bit of sort of smoke and mirrors, if you like, of what's going on. And it's absolutely correct what Vincent is saying, that inflation is probably going to eat up quite a lot of the increases in wages that we're seeing at present. Particularly interesting is the public sector removal of this pay pause, as I think the Chancellor would like to call it, rather than pay freeze. And that, of course, is going to be funded by government departments, unless something else is announced today. What this means really is that the departments that are going to be squeezed, in fact, most of them will be, because of the fiscal rules that the Chancellor is going to announce, we're going to end up, of course, with cuts in other types of services that various departments can offer, apart, of course, from the National Health Service, which is receiving extra cash, this extra 6 billion that we saw announced in order to make up for the backlog that we already have in terms of, you know, looking after people who've been ill and have not been able to have access to the National Health Service because of COVID.
Mm. I mean, Vincent, Treasury briefed journalists on details of the budget over the weekend, despite warnings by the House Speaker, Lindsay Hoyle, we heard him earlier, that they should be put to the House first. Why was this done? I mean, surely it's unethical and there has to be a different way to manage the media message.
Yeah, well, of course, they can't put out anything that is market sensitive, but they want to get as many good days of headlines as possible out of the budget. And you have to go all the way back. You know, Hugh Dalton, who was Chancellor in Attlee's post-war Labour government, he quit had to quit in 1947 due to leaking of a budget. But we are so far from that now. And it has been a creep over the last 15 or 20 years where modern chancellors do kind of have these theme days building up to the announcement. But it does mean, do they have anything left? Are there any sort of rabbits that he can pull? But also, does the budget start to come apart, as we're seeing with this analysis? We don't have all the details, but we can still sort of work some things out in the time ahead of it. Now, as you mentioned, the Speaker, Sir Lindsay Hoyle, is furious about this. He's addressed Commons twice over the past couple of days, talking about it being disrespectful to MPs. But really, there is no kind of restrictions that they can put on chancellors as long as they don't put out any market-sensitive information.
And Vicky, finally, yet another leak has been about plans to implement the Plan B COVID strategy. What is that and how might it impact the economy?
Well, that was really interesting because that came out yesterday. I think there were two leaks yesterday. I think one was the 18 billion that it's going to cost us, I think, to impose restrictions for another 5 months. Because I think the opposition has been calling for extra restrictions, including mask wearing and possibly working from home a bit more. And that has been calculated to be very costly because people won't travel, won't spend in the areas where they normally go. So that's the one element. The other one is the cost of, again, the leaked document of having COVID passports. A bit like lots of other countries are doing, in fact, in the continent, which is also costly, of course, for businesses and therefore, you know, really hard to implement. So that interestingly, would reduce, I think, GDP, if the calculations are correct, by about sort of 1%. Now, today, we're going to be hearing much more positive forecasts for the economy, which perhaps is going to allow the Chancellor to find a little bit more money for some rabbit, perhaps an extra rabbit. I think we've seen so many, but there may be another one hiding right at the bottom of the hat. Who knows? But the last thing I think the government would want to see is that good forecast being disrupted by anything to do with sort of more restrictions being imposed. And I think perhaps the leak was out there to just reinforce that point, possibly. But of course, we can't guarantee that the COVID numbers are not going to be going up, as some people are predicting.
Vicky, thanks very much indeed. That was Vicky Price and Vincent McAvinney there. And the Chancellor will address Parliament at 12:30 London time today.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Back in 2019, there was much celebration in Sudan when longtime ruler Omar al-Bashir was overthrown. But the agreement between civilian and military leaders has proven fragile, with a number of coup attempts since. And on Monday, General Abdel Fattah Burhan succeeded in dissolving civilian rule. He arrested political leaders and called a state of emergency. Dr. Sharath Srinivasan is the co-director of the University of Cambridge's Centre of Governance and Human Rights and also author of When Peace Kills Politics, International Intervention and Unending Wars in the Sudans. Well, Sharath, it does seem as if indeed it is an unending war in Sudan. Why? What is the history of this troubled nation?
Thanks. Yes, well, back in 2019, as you said, President Omar al-Bashir was deposed from power after 30 years of rule. And that was mostly due to a civilian uprising, a really large protest movement. But it wasn't entirely due to that. It was also, in some senses, a bit of a palace coup. Some of the military and security figures around al-Bashir pushed him out of power. And there began an uneasy embrace between the revolutionary civilian forces and the erstwhile, you know, military leadership. And so this transition has been marked by a tension between those two elements. And it was quite nasty in 2019. Afterwards, it settled down quite a bit. But then in the recent time, there's been a real push from the civilian side to see the military remove themselves from the transitional government towards democratic elections. And that has meant that various elements have reacted against that transition to civilian rule.
So what happened on Monday?
Well, on Monday, the military took over, government and dissolved government. They shut down the internet. They shut down communication lines. They took over the airport. They said it wasn't a coup, but in every other respect, it looks like a coup and smells like a coup. What happened thereafter is that the military took the former Prime Minister Hamdok into house arrest and took him to a separate location. They have released him since then back to house arrest. But what's quite clear is that the military has dissolved the government and will seek to reconstitute a different transitional government from here on.
How have they justified this? What are they saying?
The leader of the coup is General Burhan, and he was immediately saying that this was an attempt to avert civil war, that there was deep dissatisfaction with the civilian government, and this was the only way to avert that crisis. Now, that's not an uncommon way of justifying a military coup, but the idea that there was deep tension is true and clear. And one thing that's really striking about this is it's not clear to what extent some of the security forces, so quite different from the military, regime itself, that were very close to al-Bashir, led by one of the former Janjaweed leaders in Darfur, Himeti, how much power behind this coup really lies there. Because if it does, then indeed it's possible that the general who's at the figurehead of the coup is playing a game of balancing different forces out.
Right. And so what, we could see that the return of the former regime?
There were protests last week by Islamists looking to depose the civilian rule, and that was an attempt for them to claim some position of power. Now, the former regime is, in a sense, long gone. There are elements still left, but lots of the core of that regime are no longer in a position to reassert power. But the one element that is an uncertainty is this security element. Militias that came from Darfur were empowered by President al-Bashir and in effect then dethroned him. And the leader of those militias still remains a very potent force. And I suspect that the negotiations behind the scenes are between the military establishment and the security militia leader, Himeti, as to who is going to wield the most power.
Mm. So how has the international community responded? I know that the UN Security Council was meeting yesterday.
Yes, and indeed, the UN Security Council met yesterday. There was a stern condemnation from Norway, Estonia, from the United Kingdom. There was a bit of ambivalence from the Russian ambassador, which is not surprising given Russia's close ties to Sudan, not willing to call this a coup. But the Security Council will be slightly divided on Sudan. They always have been. There's always been a different position taken by Russia and China. But overall, the endorsement of the Security Council was towards a democratic transition over these last 2 years, and it'll be very hard for them to walk backwards from that commitment. So we expect some, you know, pretty clear direction from the Security Council. The US is an interesting case. I mean, the US envoy was in Sudan over the weekend, and there are some reports that there was, you know, clear signals that these events, the coup may occur. And the US will have to work out, they've frozen the $700 million that they promised to Sudan during the transition. They've frozen that, but they'll have to work out what leverage they have now over this military government. And they'll probably be looking to the Middle East, to Saudi Arabia, to the United Arab Emirates as being key actors in this current phase.
But what about the African Union?
The African Union, it will be interesting to see how strongly they come out. I mean, there is no shortage of backsliding to authoritarian regimes and military rule on the continent. And the African Union has found itself in Guinea, in other countries, in Mali, trying to wrestle with these challenging situations. And, you know, because of a slide back to authoritarianism, it's not clear that, you know, African states, many of the leaders are able to take a very distinctive position and say, no, that's not the trajectory that this continent is on. I mean, will come out quite strongly. There's always a fear amongst leaders in African states that coups in one place might lead to coups elsewhere. But one suspects that the African Union doesn't have much teeth on this issue right now.
And what about the rest of the region? I mean, there is, it's strife-torn right now. You really need to look at what's happening in Tigray, for instance.
Yes, I mean, it's very clear that the Horn of Africa, which has always been a quite unstable part of the continent, geostrategically located, Red Sea, Indian Ocean, Middle East around it. So for decades, this has been a bit of a cockpit of global confrontations. In the Cold War it was, and indeed in more recent decades, ethnic conflicts and conflagrations can easily spill over borders. So there's no doubt that Ethiopia's unrest has and the war there has destabilized the region as a whole, and this has spilled over into Sudan. So these are quite despairing times, because stability in the region has come from when Sudan and Ethiopia are themselves more stable. These are deeply concerning times. I think the big factor that's a bit different in this day and age is Middle Eastern actors, Turkey, the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, tremendous power in the region, quite different to historically, and what role they will have in the current events in Sudan will be critically important.
Absolutely. Shara, thank you very much indeed. Now, still to come on the programme, we take a look at the latest urbanism news and discuss the unique world of stamp collecting as one of the world's most important stamps heads to auction. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. Just as Turkey backs down from a threat to expel 10 ambassadors, seven of whom are from its NATO allies, President Erdogan is reaching out to Armenia with the aim of restoring diplomatic ties, severed now for some 30 years. It's a complicated backstory, and Hannah Lucinda Smith, Istanbul correspondent for The Times, is here to explain. Hannah Lucinda, the conflict between the two countries goes all the way back to the time of the First World War and the Ottoman Empire.
Yeah, absolutely. So, of course, the Ottoman Empire was a really mixed empire. And part of that was a large community of Armenians all over the country, in Istanbul, in many Western cities, all over Anatolia. Now, what happened in the kind of, you know, last years of the Ottoman Empire, there was a huge amount of ethnic conflict culminating in 1915, the genocide and the expulsion of most of the Armenians from Turkey, and then the foundation of the Armenian state. Now, obviously, that's a big point of conflict between the two countries today. Turkey still doesn't recognise what happened in 1915 as a genocide, gets very, very angry when others do, thinking particularly here of the US earlier this year. But actually, the border closures are more of a modern problem. Actually, when Armenia declared independence from the Soviet Union in 1991, Turkey was very quick to recognise it. It wasn't until 2 years later, in 1993, in the midst of the first Nagorno-Karabakh war, that those borders were closed. And it was very much about Nagorno-Karabakh. It wasn't about these kind of historic issues between the two. It was about this area of land claimed by both Azerbaijan and by Armenia in the wake of the breakup of the Soviet Union, ultimately claimed, occupied, according to Turkey and also according to the international community, by Armenia in the early 1990s.
And then, I mean, various things, there were attempts at rapprochement, most recently in 2009, that didn't fly. And then we come to the most recent conflict in Nagorno-Karabakh in 2020.
Yeah, well, I mean, the main reason actually why that attempt in 2009, which we have to say it was predicated by Turkey. It was Turkey kind of reaching out in the era when Turkey's foreign policy is to think now is all about less enemies, more friends. Actually, the reason why that didn't kind of go ahead is because it was really staunchly opposed by Azerbaijan, main ally of Turkey, for the reason that Nagorno-Karabakh was still controlled by Armenia. Now, of course, with the second Nagorno-Karabakh war last year, resulted in an absolutely, you know, thumping victory for Azerbaijan. They really got everything they wanted. They claimed back that territory in Nagorno-Karabakh. Armenia pushed out, still hasn't fully signed the agreement recognizing that as Azerbaijani territory, but I think that's fairly much on the cards. So that's taken away the kind of main stumbling block for recognition, and it's really, really striking that Azerbaijan has not said anything at all so far about these kind of murmurs that have been going on for the past month, signals coming both from Armenia and from Turkey that there is a path now open for those relations to be normalised.
And do you think on Turkey's part it's an attempt to ensure that it's part of the decision-making phase of what happens next alongside Russia?
Well, one of the really interesting things in the Caucasus is that Turkey was absolutely instrumental in Azerbaijan's victory last year. It sent some troops, but the main factor was the Turkish drones that were used on the battlefield to huge effect. But really, in the peace process, it's really, you know, politically gained very little. in a business sense, it's gained a lot. I mean, every day I'm reading reports about how Turkish companies are rebuilding Nagorno-Karabakh, building roads, building airports. There's a new airport they're opening this week. But in terms of politics, it was really Russia that was the bigger winner. So I think certainly, you know, this has the potential to hand Turkey more influence in the Caucasus, that's for sure. But I think more than that, it's also something that Erdogan, as you say, just days after, that bringing Turkish relations with the West to the brink of the lowest point ever by seeming to dismiss 10 Western ambassadors, including the US, and then backtracking on it. I think this would be something that he could really wave under the nose of particularly the US and say, look, I'm willing to play ball. I'm somebody that you can deal with. Here's an example of that.
And how does Russia view this?
Well, of course, you know, Russia and Turkey have a really, really interesting and, let's say, complex relationship. Nagorno-Karabakh is one of the arenas, others being Syria and Libya, where it's on the opposite side to Turkey. It's backing the opposite side in a conflict. And yet, on a kind of higher political, diplomatic level, those relations with Turkey continue for various reasons, particularly because Putin's found Erdogan a very, very useful way to kind of needle the US, needle the NATO alliance. So I think, you know, although Russia is clearly enjoying its kind of political dominance there for the moment, I don't think it would be in Russia's interests to kind of, push back against this too much. And in fact, you know, one of the things that Turkey is proposing is actually to set up a kind of broader platform. It's calling it the 3+3 platform. So that would include Armenia, Azerbaijan and Georgia, the kind of heart of the Caucasus, but then also Iran, Russia and Turkey, the three big powers around the outside who kind of try and project influence into the Caucasus as well. So, yeah, I think we could be looking at something more broad, kind of bringing Russia on board as well.
And yet another example of Erdogan turning from the West towards Russia and Iran, perhaps.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, Turkey's relations with Iran are complex and ever shifting. So, you know, up until earlier this year, it seemed that Russia and Turkey and Iran were, you know, moving closer together in all kinds of fields. But more recently, we've seen Turkish security forces launching operations against Iranian intelligence operatives targeting dissidents inside Turkey. These relations are really, really complex and very, very fluid. But again, I think this could be sort of one level on which Turkey and Iran might find an area of cooperation.
Hannah Lucinda Smith in Istanbul, thank you very much. And here's what else we're keeping an eye on today. In the US, Food and Drug Administration experts have approved the usage of the Pfizer-BioNTech COVID-19 vaccine for children aged 5 to 11, a move which should mean emergency authorization of the jab for around 28 million people within weeks. A timely new report released by the UN has revealed that despite global climate pledges, the world is still on course for a disastrous temperature increase. Published ahead of COP26 this weekend, the report shows we're on course for a 7.5% carbon emission reduction by 2030. That's far short of the 45% needed to limit a rise of 1.5 degrees. And Australia has confirmed that it will lift a travel ban on its citizens, which has effectively banned residents from travelling overseas for the last 18 months, except for in extreme circumstances. Travel will now be possible for all residents from next week, provided they're fully vaccinated. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. Back in July, the leader of the French extreme right party, Marine Le Pen, and 14 European allies, including the Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban, agreed to form an alliance in the European Parliament to reform Europe. But there's been very little progress on this since. Indeed, Orban seems to have gone out of his way to avoid Le Pen, until yesterday, when the two met in Budapest. Philippe Malier is Professor of French and European Politics at UCL and joins me down the line now. Good morning to you, Philippe. What is behind Orban's change of heart?
Good morning, Georgina. Well, I think what's behind his change of heart is probably that he wants to actually sort of gather together and get the sort of the main representatives of the far right in Europe together and act, you know, as a sort of influential decisive force within the European Parliament to start with. I think he ought to speak to everyone, with no exception, and that includes Le Pen. It's true that so far Orban has always tried to avoid being seen public with Le Pen. I think one of the reasons that it's Le Pen's reputation and legacy, you know, Orban, who doesn't come initially from the far right, he just drifted to the right progressively, always thought that Le Pen was a very sort of embarrassing person to be standing next to. So I think he's changed his mind because he needs everyone on board. And I think the difficulty for the far right in the European Parliament is that they are disseminated in up to three or four even parliamentary groups. So that's very difficult to get together and work together.
Mm. And I mean, I guess Le Pen's on a similar mission. She went to see the Polish Prime Minister on Friday after he was chastised by the EU. And she accused the bloc of a witch hunt against Poland. She said it was unacceptable blackmail. So, I mean, this trip to Budapest would seem to be in support of the two states facing punishment for flouting the union's democratic principles.
Yes, she used again yesterday after a meeting with Orban this very strongly worded language, you know, talking about ideological brutality on the part of the EU, which are, of course, very strong words. All that to say that, in fact, first of all, Orban's party, Fidesz, was expelled from the center-right party, the EPP, which surprisingly was still part of until last March. You know, of course, Orban's position against, you know, the LGBT community, his ever more illiberal regime are very well known and documented. So I think this expulsion was, I think, quite expected. So, yes, she's trying really to sort of work very hard with the Polish and the Hungarian prime ministers. And their aim now is no longer to leave the EU. There is no talks about a Frexit, that is a French leaving the EU, but more an attempt to reform the EU on the inside. I think one of their targets now is, I think, following what just happened in Poland. You know, the Polish Constitutional Tribunal has ruled that, you know, national law couldn't be contradicted by EU law. And I think one of the pillars of the EU altogether is that, you know, there's a supremacy of EU law over national laws. So I think that's going to be the new fight of all those far-right parties in Europe, to try really to attack head-on this pillar. And I think this is a very, very serious matter. And I think if we saw the reaction of the EU altogether, they were quite united in trying to dismiss altogether this attempt to unravel this very important principle.
Mm. And just looking at how this plays for Le Pen domestically, I mean, does she have a very fine line to tread? On the one hand, she's losing supporters to her far-right rival, Eric Zemmour, with his harsh anti-immigrant and anti-Islam manifesto, and she has to appear more hardline than him. But on the other hand, of course, she wants to be acceptable to a more conservative group of French voters.
I think you're pointing to the sort of dilemma for Le Pen. And I think, yes, indeed, the poll haven't been very good for her lately. Of course, we have to, a note of caution here, you know, we're still 6 months away from the election and a lot of things could still happen. But yes, he's been really biting into Le Pen's electorate and she's now in a third position in the poll. So her dilemma is the following, you know, she has this far right. Some commentators in France would argue even the sort of she represents the inheritor of French fascism, you know, the one which supported the Vichy regime, then supporting French colonization. That was very clear for her father. But Marine Le Pen's attempt, since she's been a leader since the past 10 years, has been really to distance herself from that legacy and past. But on the other hand, you know, she appears to be too mainstream. Of course, that will not go down very well with parts of her electorate. And that's what Éric Zemmour, the sort of the newcomer into this far right, who doesn't come from the far right himself. He was initially a pundit, a journalist, who also drifted like Orban progressively to the far right. So he's really seizing the opportunity to speak to Le Pen's traditional voters on immigration, on Islam, and on all those topics where he has really is a hardliner. So this is difficult for Le Pen. She really has to square the circle, so to speak.
Yeah. Now, of course, Eric Zemmour visited Orbán a few weeks ago. Do we get a sense of who Hungary would support within France's far-right political fight?
I can't speak for Orbán, but I suppose he would eventually support the candidate, which is best placed probably to get it, to make it into the second round and possibly beat whoever is his opponent and become a president. But I think probably because of the difficult relationship he's had with Marine Le Pen until now, probably Zemmour is probably good news for Orbán, because Zemmour, as I said, comes from the kind of, he's a journalist, he's just entering the political field, he has no political, no ideological baggage, and he's very, very strong on all the issues which matter to Orbán. When he came to visit Orbán in Budapest in September, they discussed the theory of great replacement, this idea according to which, due to mass migration to Europe, the indigenous population will be soon overtaken and replaced with an immigration coming, say, from Africa. And of course, this is typical far-right territory, this sort of idea, but it is mainstream in Hungary due largely to Orbán's attempt, to popularize it. Zemmour is also a staunch defender of this idea. So I think they could get along ideologically a lot. Zemmour is a pragmatist. He's not coming with the sort of ideological baggage of the traditional far right. So in the end, yes, probably Zemmour could be sort of the ideal candidate for Viktor Orbán.
Philippe, thank you very much indeed. That is Philippe Malier there. You're listening to The Globalist on Monocle 24. I'm Georgina Godwin, and let's continue now with today's newspapers. Joining me from our Zurich studio is Imeli Issa-Aho, Programme Coordinator of Master of Advanced Studies at ETH Mediation in Peace Process. Welcome and good morning to you. We're going to start off with a paper from your native Finland.
That's right. Good morning, Georgina. So we'll continue on the story of this UN Environment Programme report on climate that just came out yesterday, only a few days ahead of the start of the UN Climate Change Conference COP25 summit in Glasgow this Sunday. So this report, titled Emissions Gap Report 2021, is an annual report. This is the 12th edition, giving an overview of the difference between where greenhouse emissions are predicted to be in 2013 and where they should be if we were to avoid the worst impact of climate change. And this report focuses on what experts called NDCs, or nationally determined contributions, which are really at the heart of the Paris Agreement and capture the measures put forth by signatory countries. And this year's report includes those that were previously omitted or weren't, did just not exist in previous years. And now we have a total of 120 countries that have put forth these NDCs. And this report finds that these additional measures put forth by signatory countries would reduce greenhouse emissions by 7.5% by 2030. And this puts the world on track for a global temperature rise of 2.7 by the end of the century, which is, of course, well above the aspirational goal of 1.5 in the Paris Climate Agreement, or the minimal goal of 2 degrees.
I mean, what does the report say? Does it give recommendations of how we can avoid that happening? Is there indeed any reason for optimism?
So there's some reason for optimism, but another a whole too much, of course. So the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has said that, of course, the situation is catastrophic, and if the 2.7 degree increase were to take place, that would be really detrimental to the Earth's climate and population. But there's some room for optimism. So this report does also zoom in on what we call net zero pledges. So say countries committing themselves to being carbon neutral by X year. And if these measures were fully implemented, so the current ones that have been announced, we would shave off another 0.5% or degree, again, if these pledges were fully implemented. So, and that would bring us down to 2.2 degrees, which is relatively close to the 2.0 target in the Paris Agreement. Again, not perfect. And many of these net zero pledges are vague and incomplete in many ways. So that's one positive thing in the report. The second, not again to paint too rosy of a picture, but a positive element in the report is methane emissions. And that's where there's a whole lot of potential. We, of course, focus on carbon dioxide, but methane emissions is an area that this report focuses on this year. And again, a lot to be done in that front as well.
Mm. Now, the NZZ also picks up on the climate report with a particular focus on the Gulf countries.
That's right. So it's an interesting article in the NZZ on the Gulf region. Again, a region whose country is among the highest CO2 emission emitters per capita worldwide. But at the same time, a region that's starting to feel many of the effects of climate change. So in recent years, Gulf countries have really feeling the effect of higher summer temperatures, more sandstorms. The coastal regions in this area of the world are threatened with sinking as sea levels rise, groundwater reservoirs are emptying, and even this past summer in the Emirates, the heat and humidity levels rose to levels that are dangerous to human life for the first time in several years. So they're very much feeling the effect, and NZZ reports on some of the measures that have been put forth by countries in the region, namely Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Qatar, Kuwait, Bahrain and Oman. And the UAE is flagged very much as a front runner in this field, and the UAE has a vision of becoming the region's quote-unquote green hub. So they're investing heavily in solar energy. Dubai, for instance, is building the world's largest solar park, but also in nuclear energy, and they've committed almost $200 billion to reach this net zero target in the future. Mm-hmm. Saudi Arabia has made pledges as well, and Qatar and Oman to a lesser degree. However, again, as always, implementation is the key issue. So there's very lofty goals without real compliance in the region. And at the same time, the biggest problem in this region is oil production and natural gas production. So instead of cutting down on that, countries in the region are, in fact, wanting to increase it. So Saudi Arabia, for instance, plans to increase oil production from 12 to 13 million barrels per day over the next few years. And the UAE has similar visions of increasing their oil production. So again, a little bit of a disconnect between lofty goals and willingness and readiness to implement those goals.
Yeah. Now, a quick look at the Swiss People's Party and the UN Security Council.
That's right. So Tagesanzeiger has an interesting news article this morning on the Swiss candidacy for its first non-permanent mandate on the UN Security Council for a two-year term from 2023 to 2024. So these elections in the UN Security Council will take place next June. And it's almost certain that Switzerland, as uncontested candidate, will make it to the UN Security Council. And this campaign has been approved by the Swiss Federal Council and Parliament on several occasions since it was first submitted in 2011. Now, this week, a couple of things have happened in relation to this campaign. So first, earlier this week, a national councillor, so a member of the Swiss Parliament from the SVP party, so the Swiss People's Party, Franz Grütter, submitted an application to the Foreign Policy Commission of the Parliament asking the candidacy to be withdrawn, saying that this would be detrimental to Switzerland's neutrality and really, quote unquote, a fall from grace for Switzerland. Now, this proposal was very much voted down in the Foreign Affairs Committee. But interestingly, at the same time, a parliamentary delegation from this committee was to travel to the US, and they did, and with the goal of visiting the UN headquarters, getting a better idea of how the UN Security Council works in a way to prepare for their role on the council in a couple years' time. But the party president of SVP, Marco Chiesa, missed his flight. Now, it's a bit unclear how he ended up missing the flight, whether it was deliberate or whether it was the airline's fault. But nonetheless, it's an interesting dichotomy. So at the domestic level, they're very much strongly against this. And at the international arena in New York, they're not taking part in these discussions and in a way not also so vocally going against the campaign. But of course, for domestic political reasons, very much vocally against the candidacy.
Emily, you are a brave man because you're using a word much hated by our editorial director, and you are, in fact, in the Zurich studio. He could walk in at any minute. So I'm not going to use that word. I'm going to say I believe that there is a report about people taking portraits of themselves.
That's right. I could not help myself but include this one. So this is from Helsingin Sanomat, the Finnish main newspaper coming out of Helsinki. So yes, you must have seen pictures of people in extraordinary locations, say cliffs or moving vehicles, and wondered how can that be safe? And well, it turns out it's not always so safe. So the newspaper reports on a study by a Spanish research institute that looked at data on selfie-related deaths from 2008 until July of last year. So that is deaths related to someone taking a picture of themselves in a dangerous spot, for instance, falling off a tall building or being hit by a moving vehicle while taking a selfie. And they looked at newspapers in English, Spanish, Italian, Portuguese, French and German to find out how frequent are these incidents. And it turns out, since 2008, 379 selfie-related deaths were reported. So again, many go underreported, which averages around one death per week. So extremely high numbers. And of course, tourists are overrepresented in this data. So almost 40% of these deaths were by tourists, whereas the rest were by local residents. So again, if you're traveling and wanting to take interesting pictures, try and be safe while doing it.
I just have to ask you one quick last question on that. Where do most accidents happen?
So this data shows the number one country was India, followed by US and Russia. But then when we look at more specific spots, the Niagara Falls between the border of Canada and US, followed by Glen Canyon in the US, were the top two spots for selfie deaths, unfortunately.
Extraordinary. Emilia Asahua, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to The Globalist on Monocle 24.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
Now it's time to talk urbanism with the urban affairs commentator Kat Hannah, who joins me in the studio now. Kat, welcome to you. Thank you so much for coming in. It makes such a difference being face to face with people.
It really does, yeah.
Listen, let's talk about cycling, because we're seeing a big rise here in Britain, indeed across the world. I think that's one of the things that COVID has delivered to us, but particularly in Paris. Can the roads there cope?
Yeah, so this is a piece in CityLab, really picking up how Paris is really trying to, I guess, keep up with this massive increase in demand for road space that they've seen, really driven by a rapid increase in cycling. And I think, you know, of all the cities that have seen a bit of a transformation, you know, particularly driven by COVID, Paris is probably the one that stands out. I think a lot of people would have seen photos of these sort of, you know, now and then. And it's really about thinking, how do you make sure you have the infrastructure that can actually support that in terms of the physical infrastructure? So a lot of talk around, you know, bike lanes, parking spaces, but actually almost kind of, I guess, what we might call the soft infrastructure as well, which is having an understanding of how people need to share space in particular between, you know, pedestrians, cyclists and so on.
Mm. So, I mean, Anne Hidalgo has been very instrumental. The mayor of Paris has been very instrumental in making the city much less car friendly. But has she succeeded in making it more cycle friendly?
Well, I think as well as one thing the article points out is kind of Paris was starting from a relatively low base. You know, it was a notoriously, I think, unfriendly, you know, city for cyclists beforehand. So in many ways, this could be seen as actually kind of correcting a lack of infrastructure that really you would have hoped a kind of leading global city has had before. But actually, I think when you're looking at the scale of the investment here, you know, the 180 kilometres of new bike lanes between now and 2026, you know, that's quite a short time to really, for that really quite large increase as well. Arguably, though, you could say that simply there is just so much pressure on road space. There's simply not much choice, you know, to do anything. But I think another quite interesting aspect that the article picks out as well is the types of routes that are being invested in as well. So also thinking about, you know, connections between suburbs and making it easier for people to come in from suburban areas to the centres on bikes as well.
Mm. I was in Paris recently and I was very struck by e-scooters everywhere and driven, I felt, very unsafely.
Yeah, I mean, e-scooters are, you know, I think pre-COVID, you know, Paris actually was, I guess, kind of an early adopter, you know, as cities, has, I think, probably had a few struggles again. I think a lot of this is about, you know, how do you really have these new types of mobility find their space in what is public space and what is shared space, but also actually how do you regulate them as well? And I think this is a challenge in that you're seeing higher schemes, you know, much like we're now having trialled in London, alongside private users as well, and how you regulate a lot of that use. And it is incredibly challenging. And just looking at a few stories before, you know, Paris has had a few issues. They have had a fatality due to pedestrians being hit. So again, this question of how that road space is shared is a really important one. Mm.
To the New York Times next, and they're talking about ride sharing platforms.
Yeah, so this is an opinion piece and a relatively damning one, if I'm honest. Looking really at the what it calls a kind of mythology around ride sharing. So what the piece is really picking up here is, you know, a few years ago when your Ubers and the Lyfts of the world kind of really came to the fore of, you know, their role in urban, in, you know, in kind of urban development, was, you know, lots of promises around it's going to, you know, we're going to have self-driving cars, it'll reduce congestion, it'll be, you know, we'll be providing lots of well-paying jobs for people. People will no longer need to own cars because they'll be able to use services like Uber. And actually saying, well, if we're to really challenge some of those promises, to what extent have they really happened? And the article's conclusion is, well, not really. And actually, particularly when you're looking at things like the impact on pollution and congestion, there's some recent research that suggests actually in some areas it is making it worse because you're just adding vehicles onto the road. You're also adding vehicles that are spending time going to pick up passenger to passenger and therefore again adding additional congestion.
Yeah, but of course we have seen or will see very shortly in London an enormous change because the ULEZ charge has come in and this has impacted on me personally. I've sent my car off to live in the country. It's gone to live on a farm.
Okay. I hope he or she has a very happy retirement.
Can't quite bear to sell it yet. But tell us about ULEZ. The Guardian is picking up on this.
Yep, so for those not familiar, this is the ultra-low emission zone, which has, you know, existed in London previously, which is really, it's almost a congestion charge, but particularly focused on vehicles with high emissions. It has expanded massively. I think the figure is by about eight factor of around 18 as from yesterday in London. And it's really actually just about, you know, firstly, incentivizing ownership or use of electric cars because they're not subject, you know, to those fees. And actually really just about, you know, disincentivizing car use as much as possible.
And I mean, I think it's absolutely working, isn't it?
It is. And I think if you look at some of the figures in terms of, you know, I think the mayor's office are talking about this could take up to 60,000 cars off the road. So it does seem to be working. And anecdotally, you're not the only person I've heard of that has actually dramatically reconsidered their car ownership due to this expansion. So in many ways, whilst it may be sad for the individual to see these vehicles go, it is changing people's behaviour around how they move around the city.
Absolutely. I mean, it's got to be a good thing ultimately, hasn't it? Kat, Hannah, thanks very much indeed. This is The Globalist on Monocle 24. Now, in our lifetimes, we've seen the birth of the internet and mobile phones, which totally transformed communication. But back in 1840, there was a possibly even more revolutionary change, the introduction of the postage stamp. And now, one of the earliest examples of the penny black, the first stamp, is coming up for auction, and it's expected to fetch £6 million. Well, how can this tiny slip of paper be worth so much? Christopher Harman is the chairman of the Royal Philatelic Society London Expert Committee, and he joins me down the line. Christopher, you've actually seen this particular stamp. What makes it so special?
Yes, indeed. We have seen the document that is on and the stamp, and in order to give it a certificate, giving it provenance and pronouncing it genuine. The special thing about this is, in fact, it is really the first example of the penny black. The penny black as a stamp is not rare, but this is an example on a document dated the 10th of April. The stamp did not come into circulation until the 6th of May of 1840. And so, if you like, this is the earliest sighting of the new stamp and its companion envelope that came out at the same time.
And how did the introduction then of postage stamps change the world?
Well, there had long been pressure for reform through the 1830s. And this started, in fact, at the end of 1839, when a letter which might have cost several shillings to post went down to fourpence, and then in January 1840 went down to a penny. So it opened up communication to masses of people compared with those who could afford it previously. The stamp itself, as I say, came into operation on the 6th of May. And so if you just look at the numbers, I mean, in 1839, there was something like 70 million letters, which more than doubled in 1840. And by the end of the 1840s, there was sort of 350 million letters a year going through the UK. So it really did democratise communication.
So, I mean, stamps themselves are generally very cheap, but they sell for huge amounts, those that are rare or exotic in any way. Why do they retain that value?
The rarity, notoriety, popularity. I, as a collector, I have many unique stamps that I probably would be happy to get £50 for because nobody else is interested in them. If you've got the one that everybody wants and has an iconic provenance, as this document does, then the numbers multiply up dramatically.
So give us an example of some other stamps. I believe there was a Guyana one.
Yeah, it's earlier this year, there was a British Guiana 1 cent, which is unique, and it was sold for, I think, $8.5 million. It is now owned by Stanley Gibbons, or the owners of Stanley Gibbons, and that was, I think, the top price so far for a stamp. Weight for weight, it's probably the most valuable thing in the world.
But it's extraordinary. I mean, you can't use it. You can't really display it a lot, can you? Well, what's it for? Why would you pay that amount of money?
Well, are you not a collector?
Clearly not, no. I'm struggling to see why it could possibly be so valuable.
I think genetically collecting is sort of genetically programmed. For those who collect, they want to amass and study, whether it be coins or banknotes or stamps or furniture or glassware or silver or whatever it is. And they appreciate things that are very special in their line of interest. Very special normally comes, I mean, if a bit of silver is made by the most wonderful silversmith and it's the most wonderful example, you might start to understand why that would fetch that. Well, you translate that to something like stamp collecting, and you get a similar sort of thought process.
And this particular stamp, why is it being sold?
Well, it's owned by a gentleman called Alan Holyoake, who's an old friend of mine, and he has amassed a number of really magnificent collections over his collecting life. And having amassed those collections, you get to a stage where you're not going to progress it further. You have got most of the material, and you either sit on it or you pass it on for others to own your magnificent material. And that is, so he has sold now, I think, three major collections, formed, shown them, and then sold them. And this is, I think, just part of that process, really. I don't think he's giving up. I think he's just, his interest, he's got as far as he can on this, and his interest is sort of moving to other things.
And £6 million is jolly nice too. Christopher Harmon, thanks very much indeed. That's all we've got time for today. Thanks to our producer, Charlie Filmer-Court, Daniel Bache and Paige Reynolds, our researchers, Sophie Monaghan-Coombs and Lillian Fawcett, as well as our studio manager, Louis Allen. I'm Georgina Godwin. The Globalist will be back at the same time tomorrow. Thank you for listening.